Our second case this morning is number 21-11765, Howard Schleider versus GVDB Operations, LLC, et al. Ms. Tomlinson.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Teresa Tomlinson, and I will be representing today the defendant's appellants, Grand Villa. This, of course, involves the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act and the propriety of removal jurisdiction under that act. This comprehensive federal statute states three times that all claims which allege administration and use of countermeasures are to be addressed in an exclusive federal cause of action, in an exclusive federal special court, and through an exclusive federal administrative process. Congress has expressly barred all else, leaving no independent state right.
And well, you said a lot there. I'm not sure a lot of that is supported by the statutory language.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that...
I mean, where is the exclusive federal... Let me tell you where I'm coming from.
Sure.
So you understand the context of my question. If this act said, for example, that once the secretary declares this type of an emergency, until the secretary rescinds the emergency, all claims for injury, right, are preempted, or that there's immunity. That's a different sort of ballgame. But that's not what this act decrees, right? This act says that you have your clients and entities in their position have immunities for certain acts taken, not all acts, but certain acts taken, right? And then it carves out liability from that exception for willfulness. And I'm paraphrasing, of course. Mm-hmm. That's not the sort of scheme you described in your opening statement.
Sure. Well, I would say, Your Honor, it does provide for absolute immunity of the broadest sort, arising from, relating to, and so forth, three different types of immunity from suit and liability for all claims arising from the use and administration of countercover measures.
So let's talk about a hypothetical.
Yes. Okay?
Before COVID hit and before the secretary issued his declaration, mm-hmm. her declaration, one of your clients had been told that at a certain facility, right, that there was a problem with the ceiling and that it needed to be fixed or else there was a chance that it might collapse. Your client didn't take action. Mm-hmm. After the secretary declares the emergency, the ceiling collapses and kills one of the residents.
Correct.
Does your client have immunity?
Not under the PREP Act, Your Honor.
Because no, of course. So that's what my point is, that it is not full-fledged immunity for everything that happens during a course of a declared emergency. It's specific to whether or not the liability alleged arises from or is related to some of the countermeasures or decrees ordered by federal law, right?
All of the covered countermeasures, Your Honor. And I believe that is what I said in my sentence. It would be all of the covered countermeasures.
But it doesn't talk about inaction, which is really what the plaintiff's complaint alleges that your client did.
Well, I would take exception. I believe that the plaintiff's complaint does. But let me say that the PREP Act actually addresses acts and omissions 8 times in the statutory language itself. We know that the complaint does allege actual use. In multiple paragraphs, it talks about the donning of masks, the improper donning of masks, the use or the misuse of KN95 N95 masks, which are covered countermeasures.
Counsel, it seems to me that this dovetails a little bit with what Judge Jordan asked you, you bite off a little more that you could chew, but that you don't necessarily have to. Under beneficial, what is the question that we ask?
Right. Is there an exclusive cause of action?
Right. Is there an exclusive cause of action?
Yes, sir, there is.
The question is not how broad the immunity is. The question mm-hmm. is not how broad the preemption statute is, although I agree with you, they're quite broad.
Mm-hmm.
The question, it seems to me, is there an exclusive cause of action? And then second question, does this complaint fall within the scope of that exclusive cause of action?
Correct.
What evidence in the statute is there about, A, what the cause of action it creates, And B, why that's exclusive? Because that seems to be the question Beneficial asks us to ask.
What the cause of action does it create?
Yeah, what is the cause of action in the PREP Act?
Right, it's a cause of action as to whether they were administered countermeasures in accordance with HHS and AHJs.
Counsel, I don't know that's the cause of action that's there. The cause of action, it seems to me, is under, and we're looking at 247D-60 at D1.
Yes.
Which is exception to the immunity.
Correct.
It says, subject to subsection F, so subject to sub-exceptions, the sole exception to the immunity from suit and liability of covered persons set forth in A shall be for the exclusive federal cause of action. Ah, key language, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Against a covered person to for a death or serious physical injury proximately caused by the willful misconduct by such covered person.
Correct, Your Honor. Those are the elements of the PREP Act.
That's,
correct.
That is the cause of action.
Yes, Your Honor, with the standard of liability being willful misconduct.
Correct. What evidence are we looking for to see whether Congress intended to create an exclusive cause of action in D1 of 247D-60?
Well, we know we have a covered person because we have the response letter. And
Not whether this cause of action follows within it. We'll get there in a second.
Okay. All right.
Whether Congress intended by that, what I just read you, and anywhere else, that is the exclusive cause of action.
I'm sorry. I would say the express, I may not be following you, that language you just read is the exclusive cause of action.
That's pretty darn good evidence, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Is there any other evidence in the statute?
Well, I would say it reiterates itself over and over again with defining those terms and laying out the process in subsection E, for instance, of exactly how this is to proceed. I would say also that it's exclusive federal jurisdiction with a special
Let's look
court,
at that. So that's E1.
Yes, sir.
Titled Exclusive Federal Jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
And it says any action under D, meaning the one I just read you, shall be filed and maintained only in, so that cause of action can only be filed in one particular court, which is the D.C. District Court, right?
Correct. A special court under 2284.
Right.
Which I think is particularly important here because I do believe that adds credibility and strength to the removal and perhaps is an express removal jurisdiction as we're used to under the Price-Anderson Act or something of that nature, or the Public Health Service Act, which this is an amendment to, but clearly says you have to get in the federal court system because there's only one place this can be.
So then let's go to the next question, which is, does this cause of action fall within it? So Judge Lagoa asked you about the action-inaction prong, and then the other thing is whether this complaint alleges willfulness or not, or negligence. Those
yes.
seem to be the two ways to carve out from what is the exclusive cause of action. So going back to the elements that we read from D1, is there any indication in that language about the creation of the cause of action that says anything about action or inaction?
Is there anything in the cause of action?
Right.
Well, it
draws that distinction between action and
right. Inaction. When you go down to look at the definition of willful misconduct, you will see that it mentions on multiple occasions acts and omissions. Acts and omissions are also
so the cause of action
noted in E3.
So yes. The cause of action includes omissions.
Yes, it does. And I would say that's also been accepted by the Maglioli Third Circuit case. So that's a non-issue, I would submit.
Okay, then let's go to the willfulness, because your opposing counsel in brief and argued below says, and a lot of the cases, if you look almost uniformly around the country, says we allege negligence, not willful conduct. And so we're outside of the exclusive cause of action.
Right.
Why is that not the case here?
Right. Well, they actually do allege willful misconduct in multiple paragraphs throughout their complaint, 16, 76, 89, 101, and 114. They actually parrot the language of willful misconduct under subsection C.
So let's look at paragraph 16 of the complaint. This is at page 5, docket entry 1-1. Mm-hmm. Quote, alternatively, defendants' actions were willful misconduct in the form of gross reckless behavior. Defendants' actions were in disregard of a known and obvious risk that is so great that it made it highly probable that harm would outweigh any benefit. That's the definition of willful misconduct.
Yes, sir, in the statute itself.
Right,
and then
going to count one, for example, but this is realleged everywhere, paragraph 76, quote, alternatively, GVDB's conduct rose to the level of willful misconduct or gross negligence. Its conduct was in disregard of a known or obvious risk that is so great as to make it highly probable that the harm it caused outweighed any actions it took, right?
Yes.
were those allegations in any of the complaints in any of the district court cases where the district court found that the complaints were outside of the exclusive cause of action?
I do not know that that express language is in the complaints, but I can tell you there were allegations in the complaint of wanton conduct and things of that nature.
In the Third Circuit case, the Maglioli one, were there any allegations of willful misconduct?
I believe there was an argument, which of course was rejected by the Third Circuit, that there was indeed willful misconduct language in there, and I believe there might have been an abuse claim or something of that that would have some sort of a intent element or evidence involved. That was the argument of the counsel. So, yes, and I would say, Your Honor, too, I understand that this case does have a couple of components. One, they actually allege willful misconduct, parroting the language of the statute throughout the entirety of their four counts. And they also have filed with the CCPF, the PREP Act administrative process, which I think concedes that this case actually falls under the PREP Act for the use and administration of covered countermeasures. I would say, too, to the extent that they're attempting to allege negligence claims, that under the Davila analysis, that in no event, when Congress has this broad of an immunity, a preemption, an exclusive cause of action, an exclusive federal court, can a lesser standard of liability be allowed to escape the grasp of what is a clear intent to have these cases funneled into the DDC for uniform national security assessment.
Counsel, I'm not sure I agree with that last point, but I do want to hear from your opposing counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Stryker.
So, counsel, before you begin, before your time goes, the three things that I want you to address, and I'm only speaking for myself, are sweep away the language of the immunity and the preemption statute, which I think blind us a little bit, and focus on, is the cause of action that is created in D1 an exclusive cause of action, number one. Number two, if so, does the willfulness in the that's defined in that cause of action include omissions, as defined in the Act? And three, does your complaint allege both actions, and does your complaint allege willful misconduct? Those are the three things I think that I'm, the three big questions I have.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Grace Stryker on behalf of the plaintiff appellees, Howard Schleider and Felice Vinerab, and I will start in the manner that you've asked. The PREP Act does create an exclusive cause of action for willful misconduct, but that doesn't mean it's a complete preemption statute altogether. And that's what the Saldana Court found. So not only do you have to have an exclusive cause of action, but you also have to have an intent from the legislature to completely displace an entire area of law. So here, the willful misconduct cause of action only displaces a small subset of the type of actions that could be brought under the PREP Act.
I tend to agree with most of what you said. Do you agree that if your cause of action, and that's where we get to the second and third questions, if your cause of action fell within that, that would be that would fall within the removal jurisdiction as a completely preempted cause of action? That's a big if. I'm asking you to assume.
I might have missed something, but if two things. If you followed the Maglioli court and said the fact that this will...
I'm asking you. I know what the Maglioli...
No, I would say go with what the Saldana court has held, because I think that reasoning is more persuasive when you only have a small subset of claims that are have an exclusive cause of cause of action created for them, that doesn't demonstrate the intent by the legislature to completely preempt that whole area of law.
Well, I agree, but those are two different things. Field preemption... Or a statute of the kind that Judge Jordan first asked about, which is every claim that is here, like essentially the Price-Anderson Act. You know, if you have a state claim that falls within nuclear regulation, it's coming to federal court. We don't have that. That's clear. But in beneficial, Congress said there are two ways to do this. One is the Price-Anderson way, and the other way is to create an exclusive cause of action that Congress intends to be exclusively federal. right? That isn't that what beneficial essentially says? Mm-hmm. Yeah, is that a yes?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. We're recording this, so I got to get the yeses. You've done depositions. Yeah. So the question for us is this an exclusive cause of action? I think I hear you saying that you agree that at least it is a narrow, it is a small exclusive cause of action.
Yes. I mean, it expressly says it is. It's narrow. But again, we don't think that that leads to it being a complete preemption statute. And then we also don't think...
I'm having trouble following that. If Congress intended to create an exclusive cause of action, think of the beneficial case, the National Bank Act. It didn't say anything related to a national bank is preempted. That would be huge. All it said was usury claims against a national bank are preempted, because that's what Section 86 and 85 said. And so the question here is, does D1, subsection D, subsection 1, which creates a cause of action for willful misconduct that caused a serious injury by a covered person, is that cause of action completely preempted? Did Congress intend that?
Yes, that cause of action.
Okay. So we agree on that. So then the next question is, does the willful misconduct include omissions?
So the willful misconduct segment of the statute does say omissions. And in our brief, when I wrote that omissions are not included, that was because the rest of the statute doesn't reference omissions. All of those 8 references to omissions are only within the willful misconduct section. But I think maybe focusing on the word omissions isn't quite the way to go, because really what we're looking for is the causal connection between the countermeasure and the injury. So you could have an omission that leads to a covered injury, and you could have an omission that doesn't. And I'll give a hypothetical.
There's no doubt that that's true.
Okay.
So because that gets to the third question, is whether this cause of action falls within that. So you're right. It's narrow. It has to be related to a countermeasure. That's where covered person comes in, because covered person is only someone who uses countermeasures,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Right. So the ceiling example that Judge Jordan gave you, that clearly wouldn't fall within it, even if it is an exclusive cause of action.
But may I ask a question, Judge Luck? But the countermeasure, can you define, or does the statute define countermeasure?
It does, and they are drugs, biological devices.
Because I understand, like, for example, and I'll give a hypothetical. I understand if the nursing home is part of the countermeasure of giving a vaccine, and something happens with the vaccine. Let's say you decided to do the J&J vaccine before it became the vaccine not to use, and there were issues, and as a result of the vaccine, patients died. I think that would be, you would agree that that would be covered under the PREP Act.
Right, correct.
Correct. So the question is whether or not the fact that they did not do countermeasures, i.e. wear their masks or do other things that they were supposed to do, whether or not that is considered a covered countermeasure.
Right.
And that's really, to me, I'm speaking for myself personally, that to me is really the question.
So I think in this case, we can assume that the facility did use covered countermeasures. Not all PPE and masks are covered countermeasures, but let's just assume that they did. Our claims still don't fall under the scope of the PREP Act, and I'd like to direct the court to a couple specific statutory provisions that really show why our claims are not covered. And one of them is actually in the regulations that enact the Covered Countermeasures Process Fund. And it's 42 CFR 110.2D. And that says that an injury sustained as the direct result of the covered condition or disease for which the countermeasure was administered or used, and not as the direct result of the administration or use of the covered countermeasure, is not a covered injury. And then in parentheses, the regulation has as an example, if the covered countermeasure is ineffective in treating or preventing the underlying condition or disease. So this clearly shows our injury was COVID. The Ms. Schleider caught COVID and passed from COVID.
Counsel, that's for the compensation fund, right? Those are the regulations for getting administrative compensation under the compensation fund, correct?
Yes, which is, although that's also a prerequisite to a willful misconduct cause of action.
It's a prerequisite to apply. It's not a prerequisite to be successful, right?
Yes, you
have to go through the administrative process. Mm-hmm. If they say pound sand, mm-hmm. then you can sue, right?
Mm-hmm. But the point is that these injuries, the COVID injuries, are outside the scope of the PREP Act because that's the opposite of the type of injury that the statute was designed to protect. The purpose of the statute was to develop the swift use and development and deployment of countermeasures to combat the pandemic. And so it's injuries directly related to and caused by the countermeasures that are what the statute wants to protect against.
That just seems contrary to the language of the very broad cause of action, which... And frankly, it's a good cause of action for you because it sweeps away duties and a lot of other things. If you're a covered person, and I think you would agree that that the defendant is a covered person, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
And if that covered person proximately causes death or serious bodily injury, this is a death case, so mm-hmm. and falls directly within it, by a person who is injured, you agree you're a person who is injured. Then, if it's willful, then you win, right?
Except that you've got to show that it's part of the countermeasure, that it's resulting from the countermeasure, right?
Right, and that leads me into some examples of other statutory provisions that...
If your claim is, and I haven't thought this through completely, but if your claim meets every other element of the willful misconduct cause of action, but the willful misconduct did not relate to a countermeasure, you don't come within the exclusive cause of action, right?
Correct. And the statute shows that you need to have, there's more statutory terms that really connect the injury to a cover measure and not just, you know, contracting COVID. I mean, that regulation just says that we can't apply. We are not eligible under the fund.
Are masks covered countermeasures?
Some of them are, but... I mean, not everyone. If you look on the countermeasures website, there's...
An N95. We agree that's a covered mm-hmm. countermeasure. Yes?
Yes.
If I don't wear that correctly, if I wear it over my mouth but not my nose, we all know that you're not supposed to do that, you would agree with me, and that was part of the allegations, assume that's the case, that is improper use of a countermeasure that has proximately caused death or serious bodily injury for someone who contracted COVID, correct?
No, Your Honor, respectfully, because the use of the mask has not caused the injury. If you improperly used a mask that it strangled you and caused you to not be able to breathe properly, or the mask was, you know, made of wrong fibers that were suffocating, that would be something eligible under the PREP Act because the mask has now caused your injury.
Under a proximate cause standard, you're saying that not using it properly, meaning your nose where you contract COVID, that is not a foreseeable result of the improper use of a countermeasure?
Yes, that's exactly what the regulation says, that you know, the ineffective use of a countermeasure and the result the resultant injury being COVID is not covered. So under the we cannot be successful under the compensation fund for that. The regulation takes that out of...
So you're saying if the nursing home strangled the plaintiff with the mask, that would be improper use and would be covered?
And that would be willful misconduct.
Right.
Yes.
But not killing someone because you breathed on them. That's not it.
Well, that's also not a countermeasure. There would be no breathing there. And the mask...
Breathing as a result of improper use of the mask.
No, then the injury would just be COVID. It would not have been the mask. The ineffective...
Would that be considered just negligence as opposed to willful misconduct? Is that what the regs say?
Well, I think if you accidentally breathed around somebody, I'm not sure that, you know, as opposed to, like, strangling someone with a mask. But in either case, it's COVID that's causing your injury there. That's not the covered injury. If I may pivot to the willful misconduct and explain why we're not within the willful misconduct, just as a practical matter, the willful misconduct was never raised by the defense until a parenthetical in their opening brief, and then this argument was more developed in the reply brief. But down below in the notice of removal, they never alleged that we had alleged a willful misconduct claim. Our allegations all sound in negligence, just like all these other complaints around the country. And
it's my understanding that, and your friend on the other table can tell me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is below they just really argued that this was a federal question and or they were a federal officer, and that's why this case belonged in federal court.
No, they asserted the PREP Act, but they just did not assert that jurisdiction. They did not assert willful misconduct as a basis.
Correct.
And it makes sense. You know, there are three prongs to the willful misconduct definition. The intentionally, it's an act or omission taken intentionally to achieve a wrongful purpose, knowingly without legal or factual justification, and in disregard of a known or obvious risk that is so great as to make it highly probable that the harm will outweigh the benefit.
Which is almost exactly the allegations in the complaint, right?
Well, only that third one. That is correct, that third allegation is in there, which it sort
By the
of
way,
mirrors the...
You know there's a reason why it's in there, right? You and I both know the reason that's in there. Tell us why.
Well, we would assert that it's to tee up a punitive damages or avoid a...
It's for punitive damages. You know exactly why it's in there.
And
the statute, the Florida statute, Chapter 429, requires that allegation be in there if you're eligible for a punitive damages, which gets you financial discovery, which starts that process. That's why it has to be in there, right?
And that's why... So the Maglioli court specifically rejected that basis as a finding of punitive damages in that case. In Maglioli, similar to here, they alleged the term... conduct that was willful, wanton, et cetera, and the Maglioli court said that does not invoke the PREP Act. That does not invoke that willful misconduct cause of action, which is a different cause of action than a negligence cause of action. I know that there's been this argument made in the reply brief about the standard of liability, but it's more than just a different standard of liability. The PREP Act clearly carved out a cause of action for willful misconduct and put all the other causes of action, negligence, recklessness, gross negligence, into the compensation fund. And even Florida courts have described the difference in willful or intentional misconduct versus negligence as, I'm quoting here, not merely a difference in degree, but a difference in kind. So it isn't just a standard of liability. And on that argument, every negligence complaint throughout the country could essentially be deemed a failed willful misconduct claim, which everyone could then file in the DDC.
Counsel, I can tell you that, and again, only speaking for myself, I agree with you. If this was a pure negligence claim, I think your argument would be very strong, because it would seem to be outside of what was carved out by Congress. Mm-hmm. But you have those allegations in there in the alternative for the purpose of asserting punitive damages, which I don't begrudge. I understand it completely.
So did the Maglioli complaint and several other district court cases.
Didn't have the exact same language. It had the language you cited.
That's correct. However, it also, so the Maglioli court highlighted that it did not have the intentionally to achieve a wrongful purpose or the knowing without legal or factual justification. The third one, the disregard of the known and obvious risk, is really the one that kind of alludes more to the punitive damages, but those other two are important. There are three components of that willful misconduct claim. We only allege the one. So even if we were attempting a willful misconduct claim or attempting to evoke it, it fails.
If I can say something before you wrap up, if someone, and I guess it'll be us, decides that a pure negligence cause of action would not be knocked out by the PREP Act, and you have alternative allegations of both negligence and willful misconduct, then maybe we're talking about regular, normal, run-of-the-mill preemption as opposed to complete preemption, because part of your theory would be knocked out, but part of your theory would not be knocked out. And so you may, even if you may ultimately lose on the merits because of preemption, it's not the sort of preemption that allows them to remove.
Correct. And that I think that's, if I'm understanding you correctly, is where the Saldana court went. The Saldana court said whether the claim is preempted by the PREP Act turns on whether any of the conduct alleged in the complaint fits the statute's definitions for the claim. But finding that one claim may be preempted is different than finding the federal statutory scheme is so comprehensive that it entirely supplants state law causes of action. So I think that's exactly where the Saldana court came down.
Okay, Ms. Stryker, thank you very much.
Thank you. We would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Tomlinson, we didn't get to talk about this at the beginning because we talked so much about preemption, but one of the arguments that the appellees make is that you should not have been able to remove in the first place under the federal officer statute, and your brief doesn't really address that head on. Your brief just says complete preemption, we're able to remove, but you don't take on, as I understood your reply brief, their contention that to be able to remove as a private individual under the federal officer statute, you need to meet certain criteria as developed by the case law.
Well, I'm certainly sorry if we did not grab your attention in that regard, Judge Jordan. I would say two things. One, there's two ways through the federal officer removal.
Did you address that in your brief?
Yes, sir.
Like head on? Like you said, yes. We're able to remove. It
should be pages. 20 something. It's the last maybe 8 pages.
I meant the reply brief.
They
respond with, you say X. They respond with yes, but there's all these sets of requirements that the case law has developed for federal officer removal. And so my comments are directed not at your initial brief, but at your reply brief. Right. And you don't seem to take those head on. You address them and you address the whole thing about being able to remove, and you only mention that there's exclusive federal jurisdiction, which gets to the merits of the preemption issue, but not to whether or not procedurally you could have removed under the federal officer statute.
Certainly. Your Honor, I would first ask that please the court take another look at the reply brief, because I thought we addressed it quite strongly in federal officer in a couple regards. There's two ways to look at the applicability of the federal officer removal under 1442, and that is whether it's within or outside of the PREP Act. I think here we have the PREP Act application because of the access of the PREP fund, as I stated, I think concedes that the PREP Act is applicable. I think the use of the countermeasures and the affirmative allegations of the complaint certainly state the PREP Act is applicable. Once you have the PREP Act applicable, you start looking at the 1442 elements under the lens that you have this network of authorities having jurisdiction. That makes the Grand Villa a program planner. It makes them a person. It makes them somebody under which are the directives of the federal government and the AHJs that are working in tandem with the federal government. They are then basically isolation and quarantine systems of the federal government, and working in partnership with the state government. And so here we also have a circumstance where, different than some of the other cases that have looked at the federal officer removal,
But the case you cite doesn't talk about the officer removal statute. It talks about 1331 and 1441. See, here's where I think the importance may lie, which is that normally speaking, a remand to state court for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, right?
Correct.
Or for any other reason in 1447, I forget the subsection.
Right.
Is not reviewable on appeal.
Correct.
But a remand when the removal is based on the federal officer statute is appealable. Mm-hmm. Right? So that point is important. It's not just whether or not the preemption analysis you're correct on or you're not correct on. It's whether you can even get up here.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. And we had that, of course, in our notice of removal and in the brief, and I believe also in the reply brief. But whether, if you're just talking about the elements, whether we were acting under the federal color of the federal government activity, providing a role which they themselves could not provide. This is not Watson, where clearly the government doesn't design or manufacture cigarettes. But what the government does do is in instances of national security threats, particularly public health emergencies, they do marshal to stop transmission. They could not have developed congregate living facilities for the nation's most vulnerable persons under this pandemic without working with and utilizing the facilities of long-term care facilities such as Grand Villa.
You've answered my question, and I didn't want to take you away from your attempted yes. rebuttal, so I'll give you three more minutes to be able to.
And I do have some things. I just want to make sure that the court knows this decision is so important. As I know you know, this is the home of the CDC, for goodness sake. The 11th Circuit has to get this right, because God forbid there may be another national public health challenge and people need to know where they stand on this.
Counsel, yes. I will tell you, the part that I really need your rebuttal on,
yes.
that I want to hear about is, and it's not really fleshed out very much in the briefing, is something that came up here regarding what I'll call the proximate cause standard, or the causation standard. Your opposing mm-hmm. counsel says that even accepting willful conduct that's alleged, even accepting omissions, even accepting its exclusive cause of action, so that gets rid of a lot of the stuff that was argued in the brief, even accepting all that, mm-hmm. Use of a mask, which is largely what this is about, donning equipment and PPE and use of a mask inappropriately, which then leads someone to contract COVID, is not the proximate cause that the statute is talking about as reflected in the regulation that she cited. I think I have it right, 42 CFR 110.2D, I think is what mm-hmm. I wrote down.
Yeah, and you were correct, Your Honor, in noting that that is the regulation related to the process fund. I would direct you to B5, which is a rebuttable presumption of causation under the statute. So there's a rebuttable causation that any countermeasure used is deemed to be a countermeasure used to prevent the transmission of COVID. And so that, of course, is a huge help to a plaintiff that properly follows the process that Congress has set out. I do want to address two things.
But I want to address the fact that if what opposing counsel says is accurate, that you cannot recover under the fund if, or it's not considered willful misconduct, if someone in the nursing home doesn't wear their mask properly, that is not something that's considered willful misconduct, then what you're saying is then an estate or a person who passes away cannot recover, their estate cannot recover for that death.
I would say that they're reading that incorrectly, Your Honor. What that language means when you read it carefully is that, for instance, with the most common example of a vaccine, and this would apply to a mask as well, if the vaccine did not work, if you had the vaccine and then you caught COVID and you, God forbid, died from COVID, even though you had the vaccine, that would not be a cause of action. If the mask did not work, if it was being, however, used inoptimally, used improperly, things of that nature, then you would have a claim, and that's exactly what they have alleged here. And that goes to actually one of the things I wrote down that I think is so critical about the question you asked. What we cannot, and what every court that has looked at this has failed to recognize, is that this is not just about the utilization of these devices. It is about the management and operation of the programs utilizing these devices. It's about the management and operation of the facilities utilizing these devices. And so what we're talking about is COVID infectious disease control policies related to the countermeasures. And that's much broader than any court has given Congress and HHS's declaration credit for, frankly. And we have to get this right, we have to address that head on. That broadens this much more. And I would ask Your Honors to take a look at that and to speak to Judge Luck's question about whether or not any of this was alleged below and so forth related to the willful misconduct standard. In fact, the management and operation of programs and facilities is also parroted in paragraphs 68 and 69 of the plaintiff's complaint. So they're more than just trying to get punitive damages under Florida state law here. And they do mention the PREP Act, though in the negative, trying to escape its grasp. But they are clearly foreshadowing that they think that PREP applies here, as is played out when they ultimately file a claim before the Administrative Procedure Act.
You've gone over your time, so you need to wrap up.
Yeah, and I do want to address, Your Honor, Judge Luck, and I'm sure what the panelists
see. No, we're not addressing any more stuff.
Yeah, Okay.
I'm giving you a chance to wrap up. You've gone beyond the three extra minutes I gave you, so yes. We need to move on to the next case.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I would just say that that it's not being blind to what Congress has said to apply the immunity, preemption, as well as the exclusive cause of action in its totality, not omitting or parsing or selecting any phrase in isolation. Give this statute its due that Congress intended, and that is to eliminate independent causes of action at the state court level and to give this the federal treatment that is entitled to. Please reverse the district court in their remand and order that this case either be dismissed or transferred to the DDC as Congress intended. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.